8-8-4-2-3. N'hésitez pas à appeler ce numéro et à nous laisser un message avec des nouvelles à partager sur l'émission ou un message audio pour vos proches à l'intérieur.
And welcome to Ecolibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM. We have a great show for you today. We're going to start off with some music from Guthrie Govan, who is an amazing guitar player. And he put out an album called West Coast Grooves, I think is what it's called. And this is the tune Jelly Bean. And that was Jelly Bean by Guthrie Govan. You are listening to Ecolibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM. My name is Ryan Young. Welcome to the show. And today we are going to go into our archives and play an old interview with Wangari Maathai, the famous African environmental activist who won the Nobel Peace Prize many years ago, or some years ago. But first, we are going to look at a club that is active at McGill University, and that is the McGill Permaculture Club, which basically operates out at the St. Anne de Bellevue campus of McGill, the McDonald campus. And I sat down with Joel Harms right there in a food forest that the Permaculture Club has been maintaining, I guess, for a few years now. And what is permaculture? Permaculture is an approach to land management and philosophy that adopts arrangements observed in flourishing natural ecosystems. So it basically looks at nature, tries to copy some of the patterns that we see in nature, but harness them for efficient agriculture. It includes a set of design principles derived using whole systems thinking. And it uses these principles in fields such as regenerative agriculture, rewilding, and community resilience. So, you know, the development of these agricultural ecosystems are intended to be sustainable and self-sufficient. The way I usually think of permaculture is permanent agriculture. So the type of agriculture that is not so much replanting every year your crops and, you know, sort of disturbing the soil by plowing the soil and that kind of thing, and, you know, putting chemical fertilizers in the soil and using pesticides, but instead, you know, creating something like a food forest where it's fruit trees, but then underneath the fruit trees are berry bushes or dwarf fruit trees, and then below that are is other areas that we could have or that you could plant beneficial plants like rhubarb or chives or who knows what, something good, something edible, something medicinal, something that works well with fruit trees and berry bushes. And then on top of that, you could have your chickens grazing. I don't know if grazing is the right term, but you could have your chickens eating in between these rows of fruit trees and berry bushes and various other plants. So you kind of try to imitate what a natural ecosystem would do. And a natural ecosystem is very layered. And that's my idea of permaculture. But of course, there are a number of different approaches to permaculture, and it all depends on where you are in the world, what your climate is, and so on. But it's always been something that I've been fascinated by and that I try to imitate sometimes in my own gardening. So I decided to speak to somebody who is a McGill student who works with the Permaculture Club. So that person is Joel Harms. So here is that interview that I did 2 days ago. This is Ryan Young with Ecolibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM. And I'm here with Joel Harms, who is involved with the McGill Permaculture Club out at McDonald Campus in St. Anne of Bellevue. And he's the garden manager in the club. And how are you doing today, Joel?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm doing very well. And he's an undergrad student. And what are you studying?
Bioresource engineering, actually. Yes.
Nice.
I'm in my third year now. Almost finished the third year.
Cool. So how did you get involved in the McGill Permaculture Club?
I think I got, I found out about them on the club fair, actually, which was back in 2018 when I came to Mac Campus. And I had heard a little bit about permaculture before, but I didn't really, I guess, consider actually practicing it. But I saw the club and I went there, and it was a nice community and they had a nice garden. And so I thought, why not get involved? And now I stuck around. Yeah.
Nice. So obviously you've seen the garden. Well, I guess there's a number of different places that you have things growing. So maybe describe each site.
Okay, yeah. So where we are right now is the food forest, as we call it, just generally because we have mostly trees here, mostly fruiting trees. And this is in Senville. But we also have another site, which is a bit younger, which is kind of our core site, which is the McGill Permaculture Showcase Garden, is what it's called. And it's on the McDonald Campus Farm, right behind the swine complex, about a quarter acre plot, where we also have vegetables and flowers and also trees. But yeah, this site is mostly trees.
And the neighbors right beside you are also the McDonald Student Garden.
Yeah,
project,
the
right?
MSEG. Yeah, right. Exactly.
Nice.
They're very good neighbors, helping us out a lot.
Nice. So so I guess this site that we're actually sitting in, mm-hmm. Which is near Jardin Caria, which is an organic farm in Senneville. Do you know when this was planted?
I think in 2016 about. We've only been helping manage it since last year, so since 2020, actually, I think, or maybe 2019. I'm not sure, but we haven't been doing very much here yet so far. So it's still kind of wild.
And when you got involved with the McGill Permaculture Club, it was still a pretty new club, was it not?
Yeah, yeah. I think it was founded probably 2017, might have been the first season. I came, I think during the second full season, after the second full season 2018, if I remember correctly. I think 2017 is the right date.
And why do you think the McGill Permaculture Club was formed?
I think, like, our main purpose that we see is to, I guess, to educate, to get people to put permaculture on the map, so that it's not something that is unknown anymore, and especially among like the student community, who will take that out then into the world with them. Yeah, I think that's our main kind of objective.
And when you look at the description of the club on the website, or maybe it's part of student activities or something like that, it does state that it was partly formed in relationship to the fact that the McDonald campus does not promote in the programs that you're taking any kind of permaculture type farming.
Yeah, that's true. We're actually not seeing a lot of courses or activities that relate to organic or farming or even permaculture. So, I mean, MSEG kind of put a start to like putting ecological farming on the map, like vegetables mainly, and then I guess that's definitely part of it.
And so, is there pressure to get the campus to, or the school, whatever department it is, to provide a course in permaculture, and have you had any success?
I think there may have been talk about it at some point, but I'm not sure if there's anything happening now at the moment. No, I'm not sure about that.
So then the fact that it's sort of more of a club, tell me what kind of activities that you've seen happen since you've been involved.
Okay, well, actually, what was nice, a very nice thing that we started doing in 2019 was we had interns from actually courses, people that needed to complete like a small project for a course or something. They were able to intern with us and do a small project. We had a GIS intern, so we got both of our gardens mapped. I think we even had two GIS interns actually, and some other interns doing like projects around the garden, and that really started going. And then last year, we changed our bed structure actually. We kind of tried to go for a different style of beds so that we could make more use of the space that we had to kind of concentrate our vegetables together in the space, and also maybe make it easier to manage. And it turned out quite well. We were able to achieve a very nice yield, and we aren't even using half of the vegetable bed area that we used before.
Nice. What do you like most about permaculture? What interests you most about permaculture?
You know, sometimes when we think of sustainability or something, we think of we have to give something up in order to be sustainable or to be green. But kind of with permaculture, with the conscious design you can do, you can actually achieve sustainability without giving up on the efficiency, without giving up on yield, because you actually can achieve almost greater yields dependent. I mean, the studies are pending, so yeah, just from experience, I guess.
And have you ever had a nice experience where you taste something great in a food forest or something like that, and tell me about that experience?
All the time. Every year, actually, I still discover new things that I didn't know were edible in our permaculture garden. I think last year there was some plant. I'm not so good with the names, but kind of with the mustardy leaves that you can add to salads or anything. And even if you're in the field, I like, you know, the plants I know that are edible to taste them. And we have agastache, for example, that I haven't heard about before I came to the permaculture club, which is Korean mint also, or anise mint, because it tastes like anise, but it's a mint. And we had pineapple sage in our garden, so it's sage but it tastes of pineapple, or lemon basil. That is also a very interesting kind of type, and everything's edible. And in a permaculture system, actually, everything is edible to some degree, so yeah.
Very interesting. As a student in bioresource engineering, what are some of your other interests?
So I do work right now for Professor Adamowski, and together with Dr. Julian Millard, who just graduated, so just got his PhD. And what we're doing is we're trying to build models that integrate both social aspects and hydrological aspects of modeling into one overall model so that we can better manage water resources. And so we've done some like coding work. But then on my own time, I guess I like looking at so-called holistic management or holistic planned grazing, which is a very nice system developed by Alan Savory. And so I'm trying to learn about that. And because it's quite beautiful in that it integrates animals with human needs and finds a better way to manage grasslands using just observing like the cycles in nature. And where Alan Savory realized animals in nature are constantly moving, so we should also constantly move our animals. And it turns out you can actually do this in any type of climate. He has even practiced it in deserts with, I think, just 200 millimeters of precipitation in a year. So, and it revitalizes the grasslands, I guess. And suddenly where there was bare ground, grass comes back up because we need the animals to complete the nutrient cycle, I guess, yeah.
And do you think that overall in Canada, or maybe North America in general, or in the Western world, that agriculture is a problematic practice in many ways? And like in terms of, you know, the conventional approach to agriculture, which I think you're learning a lot about by being in the bioresource engineering program.
Yeah, it's true. We definitely do mostly focus on that, also in our courses on irrigation, I guess, or fertilization or whatever. And I do believe it. There is certain problems, and I think maybe one of the beginning problems is that even the farmers that are practicing it are having trouble to feed themselves a lot of the time because the system is not very resilient, and there's more and more inputs needed as time goes on, and it's not the soil is losing its health and losing its biodiversity. And once we start losing the biodiversity, then the system becomes very weak and easily attacked by all kinds of pests, and that really puts a detriment to is a weak point, I guess, in the food system at the moment.
And what originally attracted you to take a program like bioresource engineering?
Well, I was thinking a lot about what I wanted to do, I guess, once I'm out of high school. And I thought I want to work outside if I can. And so I was looking at all the environmental fields. And then I realized that most of the work that is involved in being in an environmental science kind of field is to find problems, that things that are going wrong, and I didn't want to just do that. I wanted to be able to change something about it, I guess. So that's why I chose bioresource engineering, because engineers solve problems. Yeah.
And did you grow up on the West Island, or?
No, not at all, actually. I was born in Germany and moved around there a bit, and then in 2013 we actually came to Kelowna, so in British Columbia, actually. So very different kind of Canada, full of wine and orchards, so not so much. I guess here is a bit colder, but yeah, now I'm here for school, I guess, to study at McGill.
And, you know, Germany has been pretty advanced as countries go when it comes to supporting organic agriculture and some of these more innovative approaches that are more sustainable. Are you aware of that? Do you pay attention to it?
I guess growing up there, mostly, I think I've picked up some things. I mean, there's a general more awareness, I think, about organic foods and things like that, and generally environment. But I think one thing that's happening also with the EU is it makes it so easy to import organic products from faraway countries like Spain, where they're grown basically in the deserts with use of huge amounts of plastic and refugee labor, which is also kind of iffy. And then these are imported to Germany instead of growing it locally, which is which would probably be more sustainable, even if it's not quite like organic or whatever. So the organic forces it to import from far away instead of taking local things sometimes. And that, I think, is maybe not too good. Yeah.
And I mean, the one thing I had heard was that in terms of subsidies, government subsidies in agriculture, here, you know, the organic farmer really gets no subsidies at all, generally speaking. And then the conventional farmer does get all the subsidies. And so my understanding was that in Germany, they more allocate some subsidies to farmers that are organic.
There was talk about that, but there was a proposed law that would support sustainable agriculture, but I don't think it passed. So the subsidies are distributed based on area of land farmed. So bigger farms get more subsidies, no matter what kind of production they use. Yeah.
Okay. And what about renewable energy in Germany?
I think Germany's quite far ahead with like renewable energies, but they also have a very high energy cost. So the companies are moving away, even though now there's regenerative energy. So it's kind of a plus, it didn't just bring positives, I guess, yeah.
Okay. So back to permaculture. What do you think obviously, maybe we could discuss this first, how the pandemic has obviously changed the activities of the McGill Permaculture Club, and then what you're hoping to maybe achieve or at least do this year and maybe going into the following year, even though, you know, so many kind of social activities related to mm-hmm. permaculture maybe not be as easy.
Yeah, we really... we couldn't have, of course, any like in-person meetings, which was, we usually have a lot of potlucks and things like that, and it was kind of hard to give that up. But what we did instead, we had a lecture series, actually, or a seminar series. We had eight speakers so far, I think. We had...
All online.
All online, yes, exactly. But about very interesting topics. We had some people from the club participate who are doing PhD research. We had Dr. Julian Millard, who just finished his PhD, talk about his PhD and about some future projects. He actually had two seminars with us. And yeah, then it was very nice to do that. So that's kind of the social side, what we're doing. And now this year, we're bringing back the internship. We're trying to bring more people into the garden. We have a cooperation with the John Abbott Harvest Club, actually. They're helping us out in the garden. What's a little bit difficult is to always see the changing, restrictions or protocols, and we always have to coordinate that with the McDonald Campus Farm, because I guess we're on their land. So yeah, it's maybe that's a bit complicated, so we don't know exactly how it's going to be. It's a bit difficult to plan right now, but we're also running the garden as more of a community garden this year. So instead of the whole club taking care of all beds, people can apply to us and take care of one bed by themselves. And I guess we also limit contact that way. It's, I guess, more easy to get approval for activities then. And then everybody takes care of their bed and keeps their harvest. And yeah. Running it like that. And I think it's maybe better to have people like kind of be engaged, because it's then their plot of land and they'll take care of it more eagerly.
And was there an intern last year in 2020?
In 2020 we barely kept like the operation going. We changed the bed structure a bit, but that was kind of the only thing we were able to do. And so we had a good harvest. We refertilized all the beds, did like recomposted them. So that's how we fertilize. And that's kind of what happened last year. Last year was kind of a slower year, I guess.
And when you're out there, do you have to wear a mask or no?
I don't know what the restrictions are for the moment for the garden, like at the farm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But so, here, obviously. You
well, have. Here it's kind of, I guess we make the rules, we stay apart, so yeah. I guess we don't have to. But yeah, I don't know. I wouldn't think so, because we're outside. I wouldn't see why we would have to.
Yeah.
But yeah, we'll see. We'll see how it goes. I don't know the exact procedures at the moment. Yeah.
And if you were to point out some sort of fruiting tree or fruiting bush that you particularly like, since you've been doing some of this permaculture, what would it be?
I think, okay, for fruiting, oh, there's so many good plants. It's hard to pick a favorite. I think I really like the blackberries, just because they're very tasty, and the ones in our garden are doing quite well, and really, really good blackberries we get from that. But if it's non-fruiting, we had yarrow, actually. I think it's yarrow, yeah, which is a very nice plant we had. It also kind of grows in a bush, very nice flowering bush, and actually the indigenous people of North America used the leaves to like tend to wounds and things. And you know, you're in a garden, you sometimes get some nicks and scratches and whatever, and I've tried it out and it does work. It's quite nice.
Nice, nice. And do you plan to like, so where we are here, I'm looking at kind of raised beds with fruit trees on them and some bushes, like berry bushes and so on. Do you have any plans to do anything to radically change this setup, or just work with what you have?
No, I think these I guess we call them swales, they kind of keep the water from running off. We want to keep them around. They're very nice, like permaculture building, I guess, or like construction, earthworks is what we call it. And yeah, they really help the trees because it keeps the water in, and that would be water that we would otherwise just be running off. And so I think we're going to keep it largely the same, just maybe clean it up a bit, put some more vegetables in. Well, vegetables, I mean herbs, mainly like chives, because fruit trees really benefit from those, and also mints, because they keep away pests, namely like the Japanese beetle. And things like that, because I guess they don't like the smell of onions. Yeah.
Okay. Very interesting. Well, thank you so much for talking to me today, Joel.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
And that was my interview with Joel Harms, who is the garden manager with the McGill Permaculture Club. And you can find out more by finding them on Facebook. Just search for McGill Permaculture Club, and you can easily locate them. That's probably the best way to locate them. And they have two main garden sites, the one on the McDonald Campus Farm and the one in Centerville that is neighboring Les Jardins Caria, which is an organic farm there. You are listening to Ecolibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM. Wangari Maathai was a Kenyan social, environmental, and political activist, and the first African woman to win the Nobel Peace Prize. And in 2009, she came to Concordia to speak, and I was able to meet with her around that time. We actually met in the Sheraton Hotel on René Lévesque, and we sat down and talked about trees and about her history, her life. And I guess only 2 years later, in 2011, Wangari died of complications from ovarian cancer. So that was sad. And so we're going to play this interview that I did back in 2009 in honor of the fact that it was recently her birthday. April 1st, 1940, is when Wangari Maathai was born. So this is the closest show to her birthday. And she was an exceptional woman. So we're going to play this interview from our archives back in 2009. Here it is. This is Ryan Young with CKUT 90.3 FM, and I'm here with Wangari Maathai, who is the leader of the Green Belt Movement and is also a winner of the Nobel Peace Prize. And she's here in Montreal today speaking at Concordia University. How are you doing today, Wangari?
Well, I'm doing very well. It's great to be in Montreal.
If you could just go back and tell me how the whole Greenbelt movement started, for starts.
Well, the Greenbelt movement is a grassroots, women-driven organization that started back in 1977 and closely associated with the very first United Nations Conference on Women. And it was around that conference that we decided that it would be a good thing to plant trees, to protect the environment, to protect forests, and to protect the soil from soil erosion.
And for you, what do trees mean to you?
Well, in the beginning, I grew up in the countryside, and I was a daughter of a peasant farmer. And so I grew up touching the soil, seeing trees, and there was a lot of green vegetation around me. And not too far from my homestead, there was a huge forest. And so for me, I guess I could have taken the trees for granted, but I also came to understand that they play a very important role, especially in protecting the land, protecting the soils, and also providing firewood for our people and building materials, fodder for their animals. So from the very beginning, for me, trees have always been a multi-purpose natural resource.
And in terms of the challenges you encountered when starting this movement, what were some of them?
You would have thought that the planting trees would have been welcomed by our leaders. But the reason why we encountered so much opposition is because to plant trees en masse, you need to organize people. And at that time, we were being governed by a dictatorship that did not want people organized or organizing in any way. They saw any organizing as something that could threaten their power, and so they did not want it. The second reason was that in their positions, they privatized a lot of what was common goods, like public open spaces, like forests. And so they did not want us to educate people that these are commons that needed to be protected for the use, for the common good of everybody. And as we raised alarm, they became very agitated, and that's why they caused a lot of trouble, sometimes even putting us in jail. But I'm glad we lived long enough and survived to come to a point such as we are now, when the whole world is appreciative of the trees and forests.
And why do you think it was primarily a women's movement?
I think that it would be interesting. Suppose I was a man, would I have seen the same things I was seeing? Maybe not, maybe yes. But the fact is that in 1975, when the United Nations decided to have a women's conference in Mexico, all the women in Kenya and indeed in the world started to prepare so that they would go to Mexico. Were the men involved? No. To a very large extent, they looked at it as a woman's affairs. In my part of the world, it's the women who fetch water, who fetch firewood, who grow food, who take care of families. And therefore, for them, looking at the environment and looking at a degraded environment was something they could very clearly understand. And therefore, I think that it was almost natural for me as a woman to see the need to rehabilitate the land and for the women to respond to me because I was addressing their felt needs.
And this, I guess, at this time or after this, you were also one of the first women to receive a PhD in Eastern and Central Africa. And maybe explain to me what kind of accomplishment that is.
Well, as you know, education has been in our part of the world just about within the last 100 years. And therefore, I was very lucky to be among the very first girls who went to school and who stayed in school and completed. And therefore, kind of broke a lot of, became a first in many of the academic achievements. And so to be a PhD in 1971 was a big deal because there were very few women who had gone to school, who had stayed, and who had reached that level. And I really do believe that it is partly because of that that opportunities, even of being able to create a movement, arose. Because I studied biology, and therefore I was able to understand the natural systems. And I also was trained in the United States of America in the 60s. And that exposure really empowered me to go back home and not only decide to do something for the land where I came from, but also it helped me to stand up to politicians who were trying to stop me.
And what was it like winning the Nobel Peace Prize?
Now, winning the Nobel Peace Prize was, of course, extraordinary because I was not thinking about that, because we definitely associated Nobel Peace Prize with research, with wars, with being around the table and bringing fighting parties around the table to negotiate peace. But it was a way of a breakthrough for the Nobel Committee to consider what we had been talking about in our work, and that is that people fight over resources. And in our own country and in our region as Africa, we had seen many conflicts that were over resources, whether it was over land or water or agricultural land, grazing land, forests. It was often competition. And this competition was often fueled by politicians, both within and outside the country. So we kept saying that it is very important for us to work and preempt reasons why people fight, that we must learn that as our populations increase, our natural resources are not expanding, and therefore we need to share what we have. We need, in an equitable way, we need to respect the diversity that we have. We need to respect each other's rights and space, and we need to learn to manage these resources in an economic and political system that does not fuel conflicts. That was our message. And I'm very happy that the Norwegian Nobel Committee was able to recognize this and to see that this is a very important message, not only to us, but also to the whole world. And now, much more than then, we really clearly understand. And if you look around the world and see where wars are being fought, none of those wars is being fought without a focus on some form of natural resource.
And this led to a lot of travel in your life, and I guess to a lot of international cooperation. Can you speak a little bit to that?
I was very lucky because even though I was a lone voice in my region and in my country especially, I was not a lone voice in the world. Already, the world had recognized the importance of the environment in 1972 when it met in Stockholm and created the United Nations Environment Program and decided to have its headquarters in Nairobi, Kenya. And I really do believe that that made the difference because I became recruited into the environment movement very early, shortly after that, in the mid-70s. And that gave me friends outside Kenya, outside Africa, in Europe, in Asia, in America, who were thinking like me, who were concerned about the environment like me. And although we could not see what it would be like 3 decades down the road, we were already very concerned about the acid rain and the fact that it was killing rivers. In Europe, many rivers did not have fish, many lakes did not have fish, many forests, especially in the mainland continent, were dying, and in our part of the world, we were worried about desertification. So it helped me, it opened my eyes, and it helped me reach out to the world. And it is these people, actually, who were also a source of my encouragement and my anchoring so that I wouldn't feel so lonely. I knew that even though alone in Kenya or in the middle of Africa, there were many people in the world who thought like me, and they encouraged me.
And what keeps you motivated these days to do the work that you do?
Well, I think now more than then, I now the issue has become a global issue. Now we are even talking about threats from issues such as climate change, which was completely unknown at that time. Now we are talking about the rising seas, the melting polar ice, the melting ice on our high mountains, and we are talking about desertification. And so I am even more motivated than I was then, because now I have come to realize that indeed I was on a right path and I was dealing with an extremely important issue. I'm older now, so I also have the anxiety of I would like to see many, many more people involved, many more governments involved and committed, because now more than then we realize that indeed our planet, our very planet, is under threat from our own activities. You know, you would have thought that the Industrial Revolution was a savior, and in many ways it changed the lives of millions of people for the better. But little did we know that in the process we were burning fossil fuels, and we were releasing into the atmosphere greenhouse gases that would one day become a threat to our lives. So I am extremely motivated. I want to travel. I want to share. I want to talk to young people. That's why I'm here in Montreal to speak to students in Concordia University. From here, I'll go to Ohio and North Carolina. I'm addressing university students because they are interested. They are young people. The future is theirs. And I'm telling them, sometimes you just have to listen to yourself, and if you feel inspired, do something. You can start a campaign to reuse, to reduce, to recycle. In Japan, that campaign is called Motainai. They teach people to reuse, reduce, recycle, but also to respect biodiversity, respect even our own human diversity, respect human rights, be grateful for what we have. This wonderful planet we have, it gives us so much. It sustains our life. Now we need to protect it, and we should learn not to waste. Even when we live in an environment where there is plenty, we must remember, although some people are very far from us, thousands of miles away from us, they are still living on this little planet, and our actions can affect their lives. Their actions can affect our lives. So we need to open our minds and realize that the planet is indeed, as Barbara Ward used to say in the 60s, a very small home, and the only home we have.
And in your part of Africa, in Kenya, has biodiversity declined since the 1970s?
The biodiversity is a concept that, of course, is very complex for most ordinary people. We think of it mostly as biologists, as scientists in biological sciences, and we think we understand. But many people really don't quite understand what we mean by biodiversity. But as we promote monocultures, especially monocultures of forest, monocultures of crops, we eliminate a lot of diverse forms of life that we may not even see with our naked eyes, and we may not even understand, because it is still buried in the jungles of the Amazon and the jungles of the Congo forest and the jungles of Indonesian and Borneo forest in Southeast Asia. But one thing we know is that as the planet is threatened, so are her species, the different forms of life. When we say that forests are being destroyed, for every acre of forest land that is being destroyed, probably species we have yet to discover are being destroyed. So we know that we are losing biodiversity every day. As I speak, they are burning in the forest. They are disappearing because their habitats have been destroyed. They are dying in the seas because the sea is polluted. But what we need to know as a human species, because it's our activities that are hastening this disappearance of species, we need to understand that as a human species, we cannot actually survive on this planet alone. We need them. That is why sometimes in a light touch, especially talking to people who are of faith, I say when God created the planet according to the book of the Bible, and I know the Quran speaks of the same, God created everything else. And we, the human species, are reportedly created last. Now I think that is in the wisdom of the authors of the book of the Holy Scriptures, because if we had been created earlier, like, for example, if we had been created on Monday, for example, we would all have been dead on Tuesday, because we would not have had all the other elements that we need in order to survive. And I say that in a light touch to encourage us to understand that we are only one of the many species, and we are very interdependent. And in fact, we are, as a species, more dependent on other species than they are on us.
And being from Kenya, has it gotten easier to organize in Kenya since the 1970s for environmental causes?
Yes, thank God. As many people who have studied the Green Belt Movement know, eventually we became a pro-democracy movement because we saw that without democracy, without greater political space, it would be difficult and impossible to protect our environment. So eventually we joined the pro-democracy movement, and with the increase of democratic space, it's not perfect, but with the increase of the democratic space, it has been much easier to organize, to educate, to engage the press, which also became more freed, and to educate. And that has been of great advantage, because many, many more people today are involved in the rehabilitation, in the planting, in the campaigns, than we would ever have had before if the democratic space had not been expanded.
Many, I think, Westerners know you through the movie The 11th Hour, which was hosted or narrated by Leonardo DiCaprio, and he was very much behind the making of the film. And you said some very interesting things in that film, but one thing I remember you saying, perhaps it wasn't in the film, but I've heard you say it before, that one of the best things anybody can do with their life is to plant a tree. And I would just want you to maybe elaborate on that.
Well, naturally, because I've spent my whole life planting trees, even when I was as a young child, as I said earlier, I guess it is typical of me to really value the tree. But when you think about it, the tree is such a wonderful miracle because it holds the soil together. Without the trees, all the soil would disappear into the oceans and lakes and rivers. And where would we grow our food if we didn't have the soil? So when you see the soil and you see the food, you should say thank you to the trees. Today we are talking about carbon or greenhouse gases. And we are saying that carbon is one of the major greenhouse gases that is threatening our planet, threatening to make the ice in the polar region melt and to make the seas rise. And you can imagine the millions of people who would be affected, especially those who live near the coastal towns. And when you think about the fact that green vegetation, whether that green vegetation is in the seas or in the mountains or in the savannas, in the prairies, all those green vegetation you see, whether they are tall like the trees or on the ground like the grass, the reason why they are there is because they are fixing carbon. They are cellulose, which is just carbon put together in a mysterious process biologists call photosynthesis. It's really a wonderful miracle to realize that they are constantly taking that carbon dioxide, which would otherwise kill us, and fixing it in a form that is that becomes safe and useful to us. So I think that's another major miracle that I know we take for granted. We don't even think about it. Another thing is, think of the fruits. Where would we be without the fruits? All those vitamins that we need to survive. And who creates the vitamins? It's those green vegetables. It is the fruit trees. It is all those wonderful orchards that we have. So how many things have I mentioned that the tree is doing for us? You can count the rest. Honest, if you think of all the wonderful things trees do to us, they break the winds so that the winds don't completely sweep us along. They give us shade. And think of all the flowers. They inspire. They give us reason to stop and stare. And think of all the bees and the butterflies that you see flying around and which pollinate our food, and without which we would not have food that need pollinators. Now you can see why I think that the tree is one of the greatest miracles we have on our planet, and that we should look after them. But because they are everywhere, we take them for granted. And that's probably why, as I speak, they are still burning, and especially in the forests.
You were saying just before the interview that you were coming from New York City and the United Nations. And is there hopeful things happening there from what you can tell?
Well, the just concluded United Nations General Assembly was dedicated to climate change. That, as you know, is going to take place in Copenhagen in December of 2009. And I was very encouraged by many of the leaders who were there. President Obama did address, and he was very committed. And it was very good to hear the United Nations accept that the climate change is human induced to a certain extent, and that we cannot deny the science, and that the United States is engaging in Copenhagen. That's very important, because many of you will remember the United States of America was not engaged in the post-Kyoto protocol, and that's why we didn't go very far. I also was very encouraged by many governments, like Japanese government, the Chinese government, many of the governments that actually stood up and decided that they want to be engaged. I was encouraged by the African governments, especially those coming from the Congo region, because I'm Goodwill Ambassador of the Congo, and they appointed me in Goodwill so that I can raise awareness about the Congo forest, the second largest block of forest in the world, the first one being the Amazon, and the third is in Southeast Asia. These three we often refer to as the three lungs of the planet. And it was good to hear those heads of states from that region say that they would be prepared to protect these forests so that they remain standing rather than cut if the governments from developed countries, which are largely responsible for the greenhouse gases, would provide the financial mechanism to help these governments keep the forests standing. One of the very, very disappointing or very, very humbling, maybe I should use that word, is the fact that Africa has contributed very little towards greenhouse gases. But every scientist is telling us that Africa will be very adversely impacted.
We've been speaking to Wangari Maathai, and thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you. It's been a privilege.
And that was an interview I did back in 2009 with Wangari Maathai, the famous Kenyan social, environmental, and political activist, and the first African woman to win the Nobel Peace Prize. You are listening to Ecolibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM. My name is Ryan Young. We're basically out of time, so we're going to bid you farewell today. I want to encourage you to go and check out our new podcast, which you can find easily by going to ecolibrium.podbean.com, or just look for it in Spotify. So that is a place where we put some of the interviews that we do over the years, and it's there as a podcast. So you can find out exactly what interview you want to listen to and do that, and that's a lot easier than going to our archives page, where it really just shows you the dates of the various shows on CKUT. So you can also follow our show on Facebook by going to facebook.com/EcoLibriumCKUT Montreal. And you can follow me on Twitter at Ryan V. Young. And you can follow me on Instagram at Ryan Young Naturalist. We're going to leave you with some music. And there was a band that was formed around Bill Bruford, the famous jazz fusion slash progressive rock drummer who played in King Crimson for a while. And he later formed his own jazz fusion sort of band, which featured Alan Holdsworth on guitar. And they did a tune back in the 80s, I believe, called 5G. It's an instrumental. And I don't like 5G. I think 5G is going to cause some problems down the road. But when this song was done, they were obviously not referring to 5G in terms of Wi-Fi or computers or the internet. But this song is called 5G. So we're going to leave you with that. Have a great rest of your day.
Montreal singer-songwriter Adelaya is on the rise. Listen to her critically acclaimed debut album, What We Say in Private, and follow-up EP, Woman Here, now available on all platforms. Oh, it'll take. Follow her to be the first to hear when new music drops. Learn more at adaleamusic.com. Funded by Factor.
Vaccination against COVID-19 is now underway for priority groups. Visit quebec.ca/COVID vaccine to follow the vaccination sequence planned for your area and book your appointment online. If necessary, you can also call 1-877-644-4545. Once you've been vaccinated, it's important to continue to protect yourself by following the basic health guidelines. The vaccine, a safe way to protect ourselves. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec. We'll be right back.
at a friend's place and before entering a store, I wash my hands as soon as I can. I do it to protect the ones I love, my grandson, my husband, so I can continue to have people over this summer and enjoy weekends camping with my family. Because COVID-19 is still around, let's keep at it. Let's continue to properly protect ourselves. We're fighting the virus, so take a stand. Wash your hands.
All against one. All against COVID-19. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
Just woke up in sunny Manchester. Yo, this is Roots Manuva on CKUT on 90.3 Montreal. Check it out.
Travel near, travel far. It's sickly bizarre. Ain't a sound that plays so. Ain't a sound that stays so. Relevant to all soldier movement. Bringing improvement. Bashment and groovement. See the dub stack high. Quality supply. Tunes you don't.